From Birmingham, Alabama, this is ARC Stories Radio. The stories you're about to hear are true, personal, and told by the people who live them in front of a live audience at one of our ARC Stories events.
To go, and now I still got to face the judge. He says, how do you plead? I plead guilty, Your Honor. And he stops, and he actually reads the file. He looks up, and he says, I don't know who you are, sir, but you've done a very good job representing yourself here today.
I'm Taylor Robinson, and today we have four stories where our storytellers learn something new about both themselves and others.
Ran over to one of my favorite students, her name was Diana, and I said, Diana, what does this mean? And I put my thumb on her chin, and she just looked at me, and she said, quality, beauty, value.
We created ARC Stories to give Birmingham a place to tell its stories to the world. So coming up after the news, Birmingham's own true stories. Welcome to ARC Stories Radio. I'm Taylor Robinson, and I'm joined by my co-host, Chris Kinsley.
Today, you'll hear four stories, each recorded at ARC Stories events throughout Birmingham, including what one man discovers about his wife when she has to endure a major medical procedure, a young woman who moves to Africa to become a teacher, though she has no training of how to do that, and another about what happens to a guy when he inadvertently tries to get a firearm past the TSA.
In our first story, one man attempts to find reconciliation with a childhood friend he betrayed nearly 30 years before. What makes things worse, however, is that it was also a betrayal of his own identity as well. From an event we hosted at the Avon Theater, where our theme was From the Ashes, Stories of Redemption, here's storyteller Bob Bird.
When I was 11 years old, my family moved from one end of Fort Lauderdale to the other. This meant when I started middle school, it was not with the same group of friends that I had known and gone to school with for the last 5 years. I was starting at a new school where I knew nobody. I've always been very shy, and I was afraid that I would not make any friends. It turned out that I was worrying needlessly. The very first day of school, at lunch, I went and sat where the lunchroom monitor, Mrs. Love, told me to sit at the same table with the rest of my classmates. I was at the corner. Across from me was a boy named Ed, and to my left was another boy named James. Mrs. Love, the lunchroom monitor, abhorred waste and would not let anyone leave until they had completely cleared their tray. But we had no choice of what went on the tray. When Mrs. Love's rounds took her to my table, Ed, James, and I all had Brussels sprouts still on our lunch tray. And Mrs. Love was just furious. She put her hands on her hips. She said, "Boys, you know you can't leave till you eat your Brussels sprouts." And she went off to say the same thing to somebody else. Well, Ed and I held our noses and we choked and we gagged and we heaved, but we got them down. We kept them down. But James, instead of eating them, took his spork and mashed them into a pulp, which he then scooped into his empty milk carton. Mrs. Love came back by the table, saw the three empty trays, congratulated the three of us on doing our bit to end world hunger, and told us we were free to go. But I raised my hand. I said, "Mrs. Love, James has to finish drinking his milk." And she put her hands on her. She said, "James, you know you can't leave this table till you finish that milk. I'm gonna stand here and watch you do it." So he did, which Ed and I thought was wonderful. If we had to suffer, so should he. And when he finished gagging it down, we got in line to go back to class, and James grabbed me and jerked me around and raised his fist and said, "I am going to kill you." And I believed him. Ed inserted himself in between me and James and stared him down. That was the first time that Ed, who is a good 6 inches taller than me, saved me from a beating. After that, how could we not be best friends? We had everything in common. We liked the same books, the same TV shows, the same movies. We were both on the school paper eventually. We were both in the school play. He was the hero. I was the villain in a 2-hour musical extravaganza, The Cobbler of Fairyland. We were both named after our fathers, and we both hated that. My full name is Robert Dalton Byrd Jr. Ed's full name is Green Edwin Ashurst III. I was complaining one day that I didn't even know anybody who was actually named Dalton. Ed had no sympathy. He said, "Shut up, I'm named after a crayon." Every day, we walked home from school together, parting ways at the crossing guard. And in the morning, whichever one of us got to the crossing guard first, waited for the other one, and we continued on to school together. We were inseparable. In eighth grade, we were both library aides during fourth period. Technically, I reported to the head librarian. Ed reported to the assistant librarian, but in actuality, whatever needed to be done, the two of us did it together. We were just joined at the hip. One day, we were in the back in the office, and Ed was telling a story that involved expansive gestures, and he knocked over the head librarian's Librarian of the Year award, and it hit the ground and broke into two pieces. The head of the librarian just fell right off. And as if we had practiced it, both of us put our hands to our mouths and gasped and stared at Miss Costello, because even though Ed had done it, we were that simpatico. I was just as mortified. And Miss Costello saw the looks on our faces and she laughed. She opened her desk drawer and took out a tube of crazy glue. And as she glued the statue's head back on, she said, "Boys, there are very few things that once broken can't be mended." One day, Ed and I were in the 900 sections, reshelving books. That's in the far corner of the library. Ed was not his usual loquacious self. He was very quiet that day. He kept looking around as if to make sure that no one else was in earshot, and he avoided eye contact with me, something he had never done before. I asked him what was wrong, and Ed said, "Can you keep a secret?" The way he said it, I knew this went far beyond being named after a crayon. And I said, "Yes." He said, "Do you promise not to tell?" I said, "Yes." He lowered his voice and he said, in an example of vulnerability and trust that and courage I would never have expected in one just 13 years old, he said, "I like boys instead of girls." And with those six words, I realized we had yet one more thing in common. But unlike Ed, I was not ready to share this secret. I was not ready to own this secret. For the last 2 years, every night in bed, I had prayed, "Take this away from me. Let me be normal, please." And my prayers were never answered. I was terrified that the reason Ed had confided this into me was because he could somehow sense that it was also true of me. And this I could not allow because I did not want it to be true of me. And it seemed to me the only way to prove, if not to Ed, then at least to me, or maybe to God, that it was not true, was to rat out Ed. When the bell rang, he went to class. I went running to the assistant librarian. Guess what Ed just told me? The next day in the librarian had me at the front checking out books. The assistant librarian went back to the back of the office with Ed to fill out overdue notices. A few minutes later, she came over to me and she said, "Bob, I asked Ed about what you said he told you, and he denied it." I could not believe, to this day I can't believe, she would confront him with it. She was as bad as me. When the bell rang and I went back to class, Ed was not there. I didn't see him again the rest of the day. When the final bell rang, for the first time in 3 years, I walked home by myself. But I didn't stay alone. When I turned the corner to the street where we lived, Ed stepped out from behind a gardenia bush. We looked at each other, neither one of us speaking. And then Ed, who was a good 6 inches taller than me, gave me a beating. I never tried to fight back because I had it coming. Even though I was the one being beat up, Ed was the one with tears in his eyes. I saw those eyes in between the blows, and he did not look angry, although he had every right to be angry. What I saw was the wounded look of somebody who had not been betrayed by an enemy, which is bad enough, but somebody who had been betrayed by his best friend. And when I saw that look, I knew I had broken something that couldn't be mended. Ed didn't speak to me anymore. We avoided each other in school, and people noticed. We were both asked many times, "What's wrong? What's wrong? What's going on?" We both gave the same answer, "Nothing. Nothing. Everything's fine." But of course, it wasn't. Every time I saw Ed, I was reminded of how I had betrayed him, and I felt like dirt. I still was nowhere near ready to claim that secret as my own, but I felt like dirt. And soon the guilt turned to shame. So towards the end of the school year, when Ed's father was transferred out of state, something that just 9 months earlier would have caused a great deal of grief in me, all I felt was relief. Because I would no longer be reminded every time I saw him in class of my betrayal. Or so I thought. Even though Ed was gone, I was constantly reminded of what I had done to my best friend. As I continued to grow up, and now in high school, every time I had a crush on somebody, it reminded me of how I had betrayed Ed. And even though I still could not admit it about myself to myself, I desperately wanted to apologize to him. But I had no idea where he was living. I didn't know if he was living. There was nothing I could do. It wasn't until I was 31 years old in the Navy in Okinawa, Japan, that I finally came out. When I got out of the Navy, I didn't return to Fort Lauderdale. I came here to Birmingham. That's where my mom was living, and I came here to be near her. And one day I went to the main branch of the public library, Jefferson County Public Library, to look for a job because the newspapers there were free. I didn't have to buy one. This was in 1996. This was the infancy of the internet. It wasn't a question of everybody having a computer in their own home. Very few people did. The computers at the library were on a 56K modem, for crying out loud. But they had computers at the library. I said, "Oh, I'll look for a job here." The librarian had to show me how to get online. And the homepage, at least back then, for the Jefferson County Public Library was Yahoo. And the Yahoo page, at least back then, featured very prominently a people search. And it occurred to me, I was not trying to find John Smith or Joe Brown. How many Green Edwin Ashurst III's can there be? It turns out just one. And his email address popped up when I did the people search. Again, the librarian had to help me create a Hotmail account. I had never done it before. It's my first time online. And when she had me set up, I sat down to compose my very first email. I bet none of you remember your first email, but boy, I remember mine. I wrote to Ed, and reminded him, as if he needed reminding, who I was and what I had done and how ashamed I was and had been for so long. I said, what makes it even worse is I'm gay too. And I hope it's not too late to say I'm sorry. And I hit send, and then kept refreshing every 3 seconds, waiting for the reply, which did not come every 3 seconds. I went home, and the next day I was back at the library and had to wait 4 hours for my turn on the computer. And when it finally was my turn and I logged into Hotmail, there in the inbox was an email from Ed. He said, Bob, I remember the events you described, and you hurt me a great deal, but you didn't ruin my life. It sounds like this has caused you far more suffering than it's caused me. I forgive you. Please don't suffer anymore. Your friend, Ed. And I sat there at the second floor of the main branch of the public library just squalling. I did not realize how much of a honest to God physical weight I had been carrying until I felt it being lifted. That was 20 years and 2 months ago. Since then, I have been to Atlanta several times to visit my friend Ed. Like me, he's put on a few pounds since middle school. Unlike me, he still has all of his hair. He's still a good 6 inches taller than me. And he saved me from so much more than a beating.
Bob Byrd is the grand prize champion of Alabama in the 2014 Tall Tales Contest.
For most of us, when we tell stories, we want to be the hero. And it is not often that we get a storyteller who paints themselves as the villain. But that's exactly what Bob does in this story. But one of the things that I think he does that is heroic is that he does seek out this reconciliation.
Yeah.
Like, it's been years, he doesn't know what's going to happen, but he puts himself out there in a very vulnerable position, something else that many of us wouldn't do. And I admire that so much, especially because I don't think he exactly knew what Ed was going to do or even expected that Ed would forgive him like he did. And I love stories with surprises like that, not only from the storyteller, but especially when that discovery is found in someone else. That also happens to our next storyteller, only he discovers something absolutely beautiful about his wife that he had never seen before when they are forced to go through some very trying times. That's next on ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's own true stories.
This is ARC Stories Radio. We're bringing you true personal stories told live in front of an audience right here in Birmingham by the people who live them. I'm ARC Stories Director Taylor Robinson.
And I'm Chris Kinsley, the Media Director for ARC Stories. Trying times and adversity can reveal a lot about who we are. That's also true whenever we're the one helping and supporting someone going through their own trial. Sometimes major character flaws are revealed. Other times, we discover strength beyond our comprehension. And that's the experience of our next storyteller. From an event where our theme was Crazy Little Thing, stories about the good, the bad, and the very, very ugly of being in love, here's storyteller Marshall Pollard.
So on March 20th, 2013, I sat in the Georgetown Hospital waiting room as a newlywed whose wife was behind closed doors receiving her father's kidney. So I'm sitting there, and it's making me think a lot about where this story began. And it began in West Philadelphia, where we were not born and raised. And we spent most of the days during a summer teaching kids together and lesson planning over dark Dunkin' Donuts coffee. And I began to notice this girl. And that noticing continued when I began dating her in Washington, D.C., where we taught together and lived in the district. And I noticed a lot about her. I noticed that not everyone that goes to Princeton is a I noticed that the way that she loved her students on a daily basis demonstrated that her commitment to her kids was a daily devotion to living out a reminder for her and a commitment to them that they have limitless potential. I noticed that she really listened to people, like really listened to people, because I process out loud, so she really listened to people. And I noticed that like all of her friends in D.C. and in Jersey and everywhere considered her their best friend, and I found that to be pretty awesome. But I also noticed that she ate a lot of green and like my speed is like fried chicken, and like in D.C., like when I went to her spot, I would take the metro like most normal people. She would run to my place. And even in Philly, like breakfast, apple, breakfast, oatmeal, salad for lunch, salad for dinner. And I'm like, yo, this girl is cute, but we ain't gonna jive with that. That's not gonna last. And so the thing about love, though, is that it makes you really naive to pain, right? Which is not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing to think that, like, we can do anything, especially at that phase when you're dating, like you can conquer the world, right? But the reality is, regardless of how naive you are, pain is always surprising. And I was surprised when I finally had the courage enough to ask her, like, so why all the green stuff, right? And I was surprised when she told me that just a few years earlier, that she was far more surprised than I was, that her doctor told her that the sickness that she felt when she got back from the Middle East wasn't just a sickness because of the place that she was, but that her blood had indicated that her kidneys were not functioning. And that she was far more surprised than I was than when she found out that it was a result of a malpractice when she was five, that the same procedure that her sister went in on the same day ended with one kid leaving that procedure with a crimped ureter that led to reflux of her kidneys, which led to kidneys not growing for the next 20 years. And that this girl had kidneys that were the size of a five-year-old in a grown woman's body. And you get surprised by that type of thing. And you get surprised when you're sitting across from your girlfriend who like you're falling in love with, but she's crying because the only thing that she can eat on the menu to avoid dialysis is vegan pizza. And vegan pizza is not pizza. Like, no offense to vegans in the room, but like that's not cheese. And you get surprised when you have to make this decision to stop teaching because the 70-hour work weeks are too much on your body. And you get surprised when, like, before you're married, but while you're engaged, you have to stop teaching full-time, right? And you're now with a part-time job. The thing about, like, pain, though, is you only feel it because there's, like, the adverse of joy. And what I was, like, frustrated about was I'm a cynic. And which is like opposites attract, right? Like this girl is naturally joyful. And it made me so upset because like, why are you not more angry? Like, why are you not more frustrated that this is happening to you? Like, I would be so mad. And this, she was just so naturally joyful. And when everything's weren't joyful, she would fight for it. But through joy and through pain, she decided to marry a cynic, and she did that. And in our first year of marriage, like we were committed. Like we're gonna run a half marathon. And we did that. And like, we're gonna eat healthy. And I remember, so like the challenge was eat one vegetarian meal a day. Like if Marshall, if you can just, not her, but me, like if you can eat one vegetarian meal a day, you're good. And like, I eat paleo now every now and then, like 50%, like 25% of the time. But like back then, the struggle was real. Like the struggle was real, real. And I remember like putting that Trader Joe thing in the microwave being like, ain't no meat in that pasta dish. Like, this is not gonna be that good. But anyways, like that was our fight. Like we were gonna commit to being healthy. It was gonna stave off this kidney transplant for years, right? Because modern medicine is gonna fix all of this and we'll be fine. And first year of marriage, Dr. Lipkowitz said, it's time. Like you need a kidney transplant. And there's something about a kidney transplant, like that honeymoon phase, whew, gone. Like 400 square foot apartment, you all up in that mess. And you were like, we gotta do, something's about to change. And so, here we are, and I'm watching my wife. I'm watching the anesthesia take full effect, and I'm watching her count down, and I'm watching her being wheeled back behind closed doors to a destination that I don't know where she's going, to people who I've never met, who literally have my wife's life in their hands. And it's like, I don't know if this is the last time I'm gonna say goodbye, right? And then you feel like a tourist, like you're moving to these rooms, and like this is where you sit, and this is where you like ask about the updates, and this is like you're with your in-laws who you just met because we dated really quickly and got married really quickly, and now it's really awkward. And you're feeling guilty because you wish this was someone else's wife, and you don't know what to do about that feeling. Like, why me? Why her? And you're caught in this tension of like, she feels the same way. And all she wants is a husband and a friend to be like, yeah, it's okay. And that tension sucks because you're sitting there and visitors are coming and they don't know what to say. When you laugh, you feel guilty and you don't know if this is like the last meal you'll have like before you find out. And I've watched enough Scrubs to know that like there's an art to that moment when like you come and like you remove the mask and you tell the family and they smiled. And they gave me a thumbs up, and I knew that was good news, right? And the thing about that journey is, you know, you start to realize that there's this author that wrote that, you know, perseverance builds character, and character builds hope. And it's in that moment that I got to experience a girl who has more character than I'll ever have. And that she, through perseverance, like through tears, fought her dad to be the first one to do like a full lap around the ward. Right? And through tears and pain, like pumping that morphine drip while visitors are like asking how things are going and she's like high as a kite and doesn't know that. And through tears and through some laughter when you're sitting in the orientation, like before they send you home, and they go, does anybody have a bird? Because if you do, you're gonna have to get rid of that bird. Because they're too dirty for people who are immunosuppressed. And I'm like, yo, if someone has a bird and you didn't like check on that beforehand, like you've ruined these people's lives. Like I have. And she's laughing through that. And that is character and that is hope, right? And now I get to live with a girl who through character and through hope, like in those first couple months said things like, you know, everyone has pain. And everyone has a story. And I get to wear mine as a 6-inch scar on my tummy. But like, it's my way to connect with Miss Dolores, who lives outside of our apartment and doesn't live in this cush place that we live in. And I get to live with a girl who now every day at 7 a.m. and at 9 p.m. gets a reminder on her phone that she has to take medicine that will keep this organ in her instead of rejecting it. And I often wonder, like, what does she think about when she has that reminder? Because what I think about is that my wife is a warrior. And instead of being taken by that reminder, like, she is a fighter. Because it's a good thing, right? Because marriage sometimes sucks. And all y'all who are married in here who didn't say amen right there are lying. Because, like, I wake up on most days and, like, I don't want to put someone above myself. And I don't want to, like, make someone be more important than me. But on those days, I am reminded that I am married to a warrior. And that's helpful. And I get to live life fighting for joy with someone who does it far more naturally than I do, and who does it with a really sweet scar on her tummy. Thanks.
Marshall Pollard is the director of the Boys Institute at DC Scholar Stanton Elementary School in Washington, D.C. You can follow him on Twitter at Marshall Pollard.
While Marshall learned a lot about his wife, our next storyteller actually learns a lot about herself. And that's saying something because in the story, she's the one who's supposed to be doing the teaching. The story is from an event we hosted last year at the Avon Theater where our theme was Back to School, stories from around the classroom. Here's storyteller Christy Connolly.
So I've spent a good part of my life justifying what I do. So what is it you're majoring in, honey? Theater, I'd say. I could feel the defenses starting to come up because every time was the same. Their eyes would kind of glaze over in this pitying stare. They'd look at me like they were seeing this rough artist journey that I had ahead. So I started qualifying. Well, I'm studying theater, but I'm also in the honors program. I'm in service learning, and I'm taking calculus too. Please be okay with my career choice. I just felt like nobody ever took me seriously. But you know, I take theater very seriously. It's my art. It's what brings me joy. It's what brings me life. It teaches me to be present, to authentically connect with other people, and it forces me to take risks. So to me, theater is a very serious thing. But in a world that didn't quite seem to agree with me, I decided to put theater to the test. So for my senior theater research project, I convinced my theater professor that I would go to Ghana in Western Africa to teach English as a second language using theater. And let me just tell you, it took a lot of convincing, a lot of jumping through hoops to convince everyone involved that I was able to go. But the next thing I knew, I had a piece of chalk in my hand, and I was writing the word theater on the board. And I turned around, and I was in an open-air classroom full of 15 to 20 eighth grade students sitting on a dirt floor in their little rickety desks. And they just looked at me. They had no idea what the subject was. So I pulled out one of my favorite exercises to try to illustrate some of the values of theater. I picked up a book off of someone's desk and I said, "I want that book." I said, "Repeat, repeat." They said, "I want that book." I said, "I don't believe you. You don't want this book." And they kind of giggled and looked around. And so I said, "Repeat." And they had a little bit more expression. So I chose two of the boys who were very expressive, and I had them come to the center of the classroom, and I had them battle it out. So Michael would say, "I want that book." And then Salorm would say, "I want that book." Now, at first glance, this might seem just like a silly exercise, like a silly game I'm doing, but it forces you to drop into that present moment and use an honest intention. So here we go, Michael saying, "I want that book." And Salorm says, "I want that book." And Michael says, "I want that book." And they're back and forth seeing who's going to win the book. And I'm moving the book towards Michael when he's winning, towards Salorm when he's being more convincing. And the entire room was full of this magnetic energy. Even Agnes, who came into school every day, just didn't want to talk. She was laughing and she was lit up. And then this side of the room started saying, "We want that book." And then this side of the room said, "We want that book." And it was back and forth and back and forth. And this emotional energy of connection was just vibrating through the classroom. It was really powerful. Because it wasn't really about that book. It was that want, that universal desire that everybody, Ghanaian, American, anything, we all connect with that. We all want something. So from that day on, my relationships with the students really started to take off, and they started to get a little bold with me, I guess giving me a taste of my own medicine. One of the seventh grade boys came up to me during lunch, and he put his thumb on my chin, and he said, "Quality." I kind of looked at him funny, and I ran over to one of my favorite students who I bonded with instantly. Her name was Diana. She was a seventh grader. She was moody as hell. She hated the rules. She was super rough and confident, but she had this laugh and this smile that just lit up her entire face. And I said, "Diana, what does this mean?" And I put my thumb on her chin, and she just looked at me, and she said, "Quality." And I mean, I could tell just by the sound of her voice and the glow on her face what she meant. Beauty. Value. And I was kind of stunned in that moment, so she gave me an example to clarify. She said, "Quality to me, not quality to herself." So I took my thumb, and I looked deep into her eyes, now that I knew what I was saying to her. And I said, "Quality." And after that, I realized that's what we all want. So I put together a scene, of course, I'm the theater teacher, about quality, about value. This was the hardest thing we did all month, but we put together this scene based on a song that the music teacher was teaching called Draw the Circle Wide. Include everybody. Everyone is valuable. So one of the final performances, or the final rehearsals, my professors were like, hey, we want to see what you guys are doing. I'm like, all right, great. Yeah, come watch. So I'm watching. I'm just sitting back, really hoping they do a great job. I had one of the most expressive boys be the main character. And so he stood in the middle, and he would try to join this group of soccer players, and they would exclude him. And then he would go, and he would try to play with these dancers, but they would exclude him too. And then he went and he played with some boys, and they started beating him up, and he ends up on the ground. And then a girl walks by and picks him up, dusts him off, and goes to those groups and says, no, draw the circle wide, include everyone. And then they got in a circle, and they all sang that song, Draw the Circle Wide. And I mean, I was so proud of them. And I looked back at my professors to see what they thought, and one of them was crying. And she just said, this is beautiful. This is absolutely beautiful. She had experienced quality. And I'll tell you, sometimes when you experience quality, it will bring you to tears. Like that last day that I was there, trying to say goodbye to Diana was one of the hardest things I've ever done. I kept trying to give her some nice parting words. You know, the bus is about to leave. And the last thing I remember is her back. She did not want to talk to me. She didn't even look at me. She just cried. And my professors actually had to come and physically drag me to the bus because I didn't want to leave. And I just sat in the back of that bus. And I was just like, why did we do this? I mean, why did we even come here, huh? But I finally realized the reason that it was so tough for me to leave is because we had engaged. We had connected. We had taken risks. We had truly lived. We had experienced the gift of quality. And that's what theater does. Thank you.
Christy Connolly is a graduate teaching assistant at Texas Tech University School of Theater and Dance. Find her on Twitter at Christy_LC.
So Christy learned something new about herself and her students when she put herself in a situation that was completely foreign to her. Well, that's what our next storyteller does as well, only he gets himself in a pretty dicey situation that's foreign to him completely unintentionally. And the consequences of this situation are so serious that he could actually go to jail for a very long time. Find out what happens in just a minute on ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's own true stories. Thanks for joining us for ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's true stories told by the people who lived them and recorded in front of a live audience. I'm ARC Stories Media Director, Chris Kinsley.
And I'm Taylor Robinson, the director of ARC Stories. Some of my favorite stories occur when a storyteller is completely in over their heads. And chances are when a storyteller is the butt of their own joke, it's going to be a pretty good story also. But when both of those ingredients are present in the same story, it can be almost perfect for me. Our next story has both of those scenarios. I first heard it when the storyteller and I worked together, and I liked the story so much that he has since told the story twice at ARC Stories events. This version is from an event we hosted at Urban Standard where our theme was Do-Over, Stories from the Vault. Here's storyteller Dan Acheson.
So it's 1999, and my wife and I have been living in Los Angeles, California for about 2 years at this point. And so we were going to come back and visit family for Thanksgiving. And so like a lot of people, like when you're ready to go on vacation, you just cram a lot of work into a small period of time. You stay up late, you pull all-nighters, and that's exactly what I was doing, was pulling an all-nighter before we were to fly out. Now, we lived in the inner city of Los Angeles, and a lady had gotten mugged outside of the church there, actually where I worked, and being a good boy from Alabama, I had my 9mm with me because that's, you know, kind of what you do if you're from Alabama. You own a handgun at, you know, inappropriate ages. And so we were there, and I didn't want to leave the handgun at the office, so I was going to take the handgun home and put it in the nightstand. I'm rushing. It's time to go. Got to take a flight. Haven't slept at all. Grab it. Go. Get in the car. Jet home. Go upstairs. Pack the bags. Honey, we got to go. Let's get in the car. Now, we were taking separate flights because, you know, as a young married couple, disposable income was in short supply. And so she was flying frequent flyer miles from her dad, and I had a friend that worked at an airline. So I was on a buddy pass, so two separate gates, two separate airlines. Drop her at her gate. She goes to check in. My friend drops me at mine. Go to the ticket counter. Get my ticket. I'm headed to the gate. Grab my backpack. Throw it on the conveyor belt for the x-ray machine and walk through the metal detector. And I wait. And I'm waiting. And I'm waiting. And at this point, it's just kind of like, I'm tired. I've been up all night. I'm ready to get on the plane and go to sleep. And so, this was pre-9/11, so you've got, the private security, and they're nodding, and they're pointing, and they, hey, come over here, buddy. And they come over, and they're looking. And now at this point, they've closed the metal detector, and they're rerouting people to another one. Still oblivious at this point. So they call an LAPD officer over, and he, sure enough, shakes his head. And so in my mind at that point, I'm thinking, what in the world could be in my backpack that's causing all of this fuss? And when it dawns on me, my knees buckle. It's one of those moments that you just, sir, is there a 9mm in that bag? Is there a 9mm in that bag? And he just kind of says, well, that's what we're going to find out, isn't it, son? Sir, there's a 9mm in the bag, and there's bullets. It's not in, but it's the thing. And he unzips it, and he, like on a movie, pinky. For all to see. So, of course, I'm just here, and I'm so sorry. I don't know. You can't even, how do you explain it? There's no, you don't explain it. And so the lady comes over, turn around, sir, another officer, turn around, sir, put your hands behind your back. She puts me in cuffs. And so I'm trying to say, well, listen, if you'll just let me go, I'll go back home. I'm sorry, it was a mistake. I'm sorry, sir, but there's, it's an incident. We have to report to the FAA. We have process we got to go through. So down through the escalator, out in cuffs with all of the travelers coming in, into the car. I mean, I'm not built for this. Like, I don't understand it. It's intimidating. I'm scared to death. And so we go to the airport substation. They take my shoelaces from me. Evidently, they knew I wasn't built for prison. I guess they thought I was going to hurt myself. And then now they've got to take me down to the real police station at Culver City. And so I'm in the back of the car. Another cop's here. Police officer's up there driving. The gun is up front. I'm not making this up, but have you guys ever seen the big donut sign from Randy's Donuts in L.A.? We stopped for donuts with me in cuffs in the back of the car. True story. And so now we're in Culver City, and they're bringing me in, and they're going to book me in, and there was no room in the inn, so I'm on the bench with my hands down here. Not comfortable at all, by the way, just mortified, tired. Now, let me back up for a second. On the way to the police station, they're asking me all the questions. Do you have any warrants out for your arrest? No. Is this your first offense? Yes. Do you own the handgun? Yes. Dude, you're good. You're in and out in 45 minutes. You can catch a later flight. We just have to go through the whatever. I'm sitting on this bench in cuffs for an hour when a police officer comes by and he says, sir, have you ever been to Red City, California? Now, that's a random question. Like, no, we just moved here a couple years ago. We haven't really ventured out of L.A. Okay. So he leaves. Now, at this point, that's a little weird that he's asking me geography quizzes about California. And so 45 minutes later, the police officer comes back. He says, Mr. Ashton, I think it's only kind of at this point we need to let you know that, we ran the serial number on your gun, and it was red flagged in our system as a stolen weapon. That's a felony, and you probably should think about, calling an attorney. It's not stolen. It's not stolen. I mowed a lot of lawns to save up when I was 16 to buy the gun. It's not stolen. It's not stolen. I'm planning the next 3 years of my life. The glass is there. My wife's hand's there. She's on the phone crying and behind the glass. And this is all happening. I mean, I'm just, going mentally downward deeper and deeper. This is not stolen. So he goes back and he does some other stuff. And now I'm really freaking out. He comes back home. He says, yeah, you were right. You know, we made some calls and there was a .38 revolver that was stolen. And when they typed in the serial number, it was the wrong serial number. It just happened to be the one on your gun. So sorry about that. It's all good. So you can come with us, fingerprint, mugshot. Here's your court date, which is about 5 weeks away. So I'm out. I call my wife. Hey, are you in Atlanta on your layover? No, I got arrested. What? She wasn't even like, stop kidding. She was like, oh, that's normal behavior for my husband, always getting arrested. So go to Puerto Rico. We come back, and I have my court date. Now, in the meantime, I've talked to a lot of people and just said, hey, what do I do? I mean, I'm a youth pastor out here from Alabama. What? I don't even know what I'm supposed to do. And everybody said, listen, you're fine. Even police officer friends were saying, listen, if they let you go, you'll never see the inside of a jail cell again. Just go and plead guilty with an explanation and it'll be fine. So like any rational, normal human being, I go to LA County Courthouse without an attorney. I'm just going to walk in and we're just going to chat. It's going to be fine, right? I mean, that's kind of how it should be. So we go in, and I'm sitting there. We're waiting. I'm all buttoned up. I'm trying to, you know, not look like a thug. And we're there, and we're waiting, and we're waiting, and we're waiting. And the bailiff says, Mr. Ashton. So I come over, and she's got the manila folder and the little post-it note sitting there. And she slides it across the desk, and she says, this is what the district attorney's offering, the prosecutor. It's $1,000 fine, 3-year probation. They're going to take the weapon away, 90 days L.A. County jail. Now, in that moment, you just, you know, I'm a grown man, but there are some things. And I just, this isn't going to work. That's not going to work for me. You don't understand that. Won't this thing down here at the bottom, the 90 days LA County jail, I'm not built for jail. That's not going to work for me. And she said, well, that's what, I said, well, I don't, she goes, where's your attorney? I don't have an attorney. I need to talk to the lady. I need to, whoever the lady is, she needs to come. We need to talk because this isn't going to work for me. Now, you know, and nothing moves quickly in that scenario. So now an hour goes by with this thing, and my wife's crying, and my boss, who's a pastor, he's there. He's always got it together, but he's white as a ghost. So the lady comes, and she comes out, and she says, let's go in the hallway, and let's have a chat. So we go out in the hall, and she goes, what were you doing with a handgun? And they're like, I'm dumb, but I'm not that dumb. I didn't know it was in the backpack. I'm sorry. It was a mistake. And she said, you didn't mean to take it through the. No, I wasn't trying to get it on the plane. I was trying to put it away, but I forgot that it was there. So she said, well, let me see what I can do. They're trying to crack down on this stuff. They want handguns out. I got to make a phone call. I don't want to get my hand slapped. So she goes, she makes a phone call. She comes back. First thing she does is marks out 90 days county jail. I'm like, great. As long as I don't have to meet Bubba, you do whatever you want. Because I'm not built for jail. I do whatever you want. So she's sitting there and she says, now I've got to do something. I know you're a youth pastor. Would a $50 fine be okay? Now she's asking me, would a $50 fine? I've gone from 90 days in county jail to a $50 fine. Yeah, do I pay you? Who do I pay? I can produce some. Right now, I'll give it to you. So now she says, okay, that's fine. And then you got like a 1-year summary probation. Just keep your nose clean and it'll be fine. But you're not getting the gun back. They're going to stamp it and put it at the bottom of the ocean. So, okay, fine. So go in. Now I still got to face the judge. So we come, and it's still very intimidating, this whole process. I'm not used to that. So he calls my name, and I walk through the gate like, you know, I'm Perry Mason, the little thing that walks through, and I'm standing there. He says, Mr. Ashton, I understand that you've reached a agreement with the prosecutor. I said, yes, Your Honor, I have. And how do you plead? I plead guilty, Your Honor. Okay, are you ready for me to read your sentence? Yes. Yes, Your Honor, I am. He says, Mr. Ashton, in the case of blah, 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 I sentence you to, and he stops, and he actually reads the file. And he looks up, and he looks at the prosecutor, and he says, Ms. So-and-so, have you done the disposition in the background on this case? She didn't look up. She said, yes, Your Honor. And you're comfortable with this? Yes, Your Honor. He looks up. He says, I don't know who you are, sir, but you've done a very good job representing yourself here today. 1-year summary probation, destroy the weapon, $50 fine. Boom. I raised my hand. like an idiot. Your Honor, after one has successfully completed said year of probation, what would one need to do to get this expunged from the record so that it's not on the files anymore? He says, you've done pretty good here today, son. I wouldn't push your luck. I said, ah, I'm out. I'm gone. So if I could do it over again, I would, because it makes a great story. Thank you.
Dan Acheson is the producer of films like October Baby and Woodlawn and is currently the agency producer for Big Communications. Catch him on Twitter at Dan Acheson.
If you like today's show, we would love to have you join us in person at one of our live shows. Our next event is next week on Saturday, August 5th at the Avon Theater. You can get your tickets and all the details you need at our website, arcstories.com.
Thanks for listening to ARC Stories Radio. We produce this program in partnership with WBHM. We especially need to thank Michael Crow, Program Director at WBHM, who is vital to making the show a reality. The original idea for an ARC Stories Radio show goes to WBHM's Director of Community Engagement, Audrey Atkins, and Membership Manager, Will Dahlberg. The News Director for WBHM is Gigi Duban, and engineering support comes from Daryl McCullough. The General Manager for WBHM is Chuck Holmes. Recording and mastering is by Eric Chapman from Symmetric Sound. Upper Air Creative does all of our design. Special thanks to Betsy Lee, Senior Etheridge, Nate Dreggard, and Casey Sharp for making this episode possible. If you like today's stories, please subscribe to our podcast. You can find it on iTunes, SoundCloud, or on our website, arcstories.com. There you can listen to other stories, stay up to date with all of our events, and even submit your own story to tell. After all, we are always asking, what's your story?